We really need to get some opening music, like they have on like NPR, public radio, like this morning on Fresh Indigenous Air.
There you go. There you go.
So, hello, welcome to, I believe it's the ninth Voicing Indigeneity podcast. This one is titled Harry Potter and the 45th Generation Roman. Angie will explain that reference later. We are
Okay.
broadcasting live from the fifth annual Crossing Borders Conference titled Ghosts, Monsters, and the Dead, which is taking place this weekend, March 2 to 4 at University of California, San Diego. It's looking up to be a great conference. Me and Angie are stuck manning the registration table,
Yep.
so we decided to podcast. It's a great way to use dead time like this because the only other person here right now is Leroy.
Playing as a Game Boy. And Madel couldn't be here. We were hoping that she'd come on campus today so we could podcast with her, but we're just gonna have to have our first sans Madel. Oh, don't worry about me. I'm sure they can hear my voice. Podcast. And so our pictures that we took today reflect her absence. Of course, she's always present because we'll be thinking of her and for the conversation that she's not adding to. I'm sure we'll. I don't know. They'll be encircling. There'll be ways of marking the absence. You can count on it. Hey, you want to talk about the plenary panel yesterday
Okay,
with George Sanchez from USC's American Studies and Ethnicities?
and then Ross Frank
Our
from our
current chair,
department, the
yeah.
current chair of ethnic studies here, and then Yen Le Espiritu from our department.
Yeah.
I was manning the registration table there
Oh,
too,
yeah.
so but you were there.
Oh, great. I just opened the door for Mina. Well, it was interesting because, I don't, there are differences in our programs. Laura Perez from Berkeley couldn't make it, which is too bad because Thomas Swenson, who's a current Berkeley student, says she's wonderful. And he and I both went to University of Oregon. And we were both accepted at Berkeley in that cohort. And he went, and I came here. And so we had a real fun time visiting last night and catching up. And he tells me what I'm missing. Although he thinks I'm pretty much better off where I am. I think he's just jealous of my awesome apartment, though. He says I've got a lot more room for a lot less money, and I'm happy about that as well. So we were talking a little bit about the plenary panel, what they ended up talking about. The title of it was The State of Ethnic Studies, The Declining Significance of Race?
Question mark.
Question mark. Yeah. And Ross talked about, and this is interesting, they had a recent diversity award that was given to the Ethnic Studies Department. And so
Yeah, and it was really funny. I went to the award ceremony. It was really hysterical. Because so they go through all of these departments and individuals that are all receiving a diversity award, but in the multitude of ways in which people are getting awards, it becomes very clear quickly that the administration, which is congratulating itself for this emergence of these incredible acts of diversity and diversification, doesn't really have any coherent understanding of what diversity is or how to do it, how to even mark it, except with the fact that, except in the most superficial kind of abstract ways. So this one person got a diversity award because he has a bulletin board in his office or where he works at, and every month he changes it to reflect a different culture. And then he has people in his unit have a potluck or a meeting where they watch, or I guess sometimes they watch movies, they listen to music, they learn about that culture, and then ahead of time, this person gives people recipes from that culture so they can practice making them, try and make the dishes and then bring them. And so it was just, I mean, so in some ways maybe that's important or whatever, but at the same time it's these small little gestures, and it just shows that the administration is kind of covering up the fact that it's not really interested in diversity, But it's just looking for these small things that it can celebrate and say that it's doing a good job to show, to kind of cover over the fact that it isn't. But Ethnic Studies received an award. And do you want to
Because of the number of faculty?
Yeah, because
Because Ross studies, is the only white faculty member? Because
91% of the ladder-ranked faculty in our department are not are people of color. And then when Ross, it's funny because when he said it, he's all, and I'm the,
the 9%. It is funny. And it's funny, too, because, like, the way that they say it, they're like, we're recognizing you for hiring an Asian, you know, and these people are not Asian. They're actually American. I mean, they're, you know, it's
yeah,
like,
an Asian woman, an Asian male, and then an Indian man who's
Kenyan.
Who's actually Kenyan.
From Australia.
And has Canadian citizenship.
Yeah, he's his own diverse unit. So, you know, Ross's point was pretty interesting because he was saying that that intellectual work is always mitigated against this lack of presence, that that real diversity, it's never allowed in, it's never there, and that as ethnic studies scholars, yeah, go ahead.
Well, do you want something?
Oh, no, I'm fine. I've got my coffee. That, you know, what we do as our solution is to encircle, probe, and scrutinize in a critical framework this academia, this structure. And then George Sanchez was talking about the world, that we need to start thinking about the world as a post, or maybe just our academic world, as a post-affirmative action space or time, you know, like basically like that's over. I'm sorry, it wasn't out of that. Megette's having an orange juice inspired crisis. I'm not sure what it was.
But... I was chewing watermelon. I was afraid everyone could hear it.
No, they couldn't hear anything. I was so sure. I don't know. What do you remember? I mean, I picked up Long this morning, Long Buys, and my cohort, and he's like, "Didn't you love George Sanchez's talk?" And I said, "Well, I thought it was interesting, but even though he was talking about living in this post-affirmative action world, I felt his talk was kind of dated. Like it was very much about activism as a something you go out and do. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I think that's great, but I also think that intellectual activism shouldn't get the short end of the stick. And I just thought that like Yan and Ross are talking about ideas. And also, I mean, one job that George Sanchez had is that we have potential students for next year's cohort here visiting. So he's also, and we're also selling our programs. And so that was also a part of the talk and the interest in it. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, I think, I don't know. It was, I think, kind of the way Sanchez was positioning himself kind of reflected the way Ross and Yen were, kind of as a counterbalance. Because Yen was very much, you know, not kind of saying that as a act, you know, that yes, you have to be engaged with the community, but that doesn't mean you have to go out into the streets to do important work.
Yeah.
She was very much saying that our job is to work in the academy and to ask, you know, to keep asking questions, to keep changing what questions are valid in public and intellectual discourse.
Yeah.
And that's very important work, and you should not discount that, just, you know, and say that the people who do other things outside of academia are actually doing real work, whereas we're just doing pretend work. Or I mean, we do
you
get
do
privileged.
Hear that when people are frustrated reading Foucault,
yeah.
And they're like, "But I want to do real work." It's like, you know what? Theory's hard for everybody. Suck
I mean,
it up, get through
I mean,
it.
We get privilege, we get social capital, but that should never take away from the fact that we still can have an impact, and we still have an obligation to do good critical work.
Yeah.
But then Sanchez, on the other hand, was kind of playing up, therefore, what he does outside, like in what's going on outside of academia. Because like Ross presented first, and he was very institutional. You know, how do we make this happen within our academic institutions? So Sanchez kind of therefore said, well, let's talk about straddling that line and talking about, because, you know, going to the whole origin of ethnic studies, that it is community, it was formed by pressures from communities on universities. Because I think it was weird, because George Sanchez said yesterday that he was the first, a few years ago, he was the first.
Oh my God.
First not white person in the history department at USC to get full professor.
Yeah.
And then he mentored the first Latina woman to ever graduate from their PhD program in history. And so.
That was shocking.
Yeah, and so California is so diverse and so whatever,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so USC.
Liberal. But then USC, which is in the middle of an area which it contrasts very starkly with, like it's very insular and very, I don't know. I mean, I don't really know how to describe it, but it's just that the facade, the veneer of liberal California,
yeah,
of like diverse California, like there's still all over the place these firsts taking place. And so you can't get wrapped up in that. So I thought that sorry, Leroy.
Leroy had a question. Oh. He was raising his hand, but we're just going to table that for now. Sorry, Leroy.
So, I mean, I thought I didn't get a chance to hear the questions, but I would have liked to have heard how people responded to that, to the talk. But it was definitely a good way to start the conference.
I thought so too, and I like the way it showed off, you know, the ideas behind our program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's every of one of these departments is unique, and I'm really excited about too. Like, we've got a lot of people from HISCON here this weekend. I want to see some of their work. We've got people from Santa Cruz and. It's just going to be interesting. It's fun because we're such a small department that just having a lot of people around to talk to and to see their work, it's just really invigorating. I'm psyched about it. And then having my friend Thomas here from Berkeley, he can tell me so much that, you know, because as you all know, all 22 listeners, you know, like I'm the only Indian here. Only Indian. It sounds like a bad country song.
Only, yeah, it does sound
it
like
does.
It. We'll try and sing it at the end. We'll try and make up words for it.
So Thomas is just able to tell me so much about what it's like being in community, in intellectual community with the crowd at Berkeley. And it's nothing I can share. but it's great. And also just that we've kept in touch and, you know, it's been really good for me. I'm looking forward to seeing his talk on Alaskan Natives, and he just gets to teach some interesting classes, and I don't know. So that was cool. But last night I was talking to him, and he brought his fiance Danielle with him, and we were having a nice visit after dinner, and they went to visit Kodiak, where Thomas grew up. His tribe, which is interesting because, gosh, I'm probably going to get it wrong. And you know, so I'll just warn you now. But his tribe, I think, was formed when he was 24 years old because it's a corporation. And he has all these interesting ideas about and things to tell me about what the differences between Native America and Alaskan Natives. And so anyway, so they were asking me, like, what, you know, where are you from? What's your tribe like? And I'm not an enrolled member of my tribe, which is the Klamath tribes. That's the one that my mom's enrolled in, and that's how I get, you know, I guess, I mean, that's what I was always taught to say, like, that I'm Klamath Modoc, Modoc Klamath. I was sort of like, when they were talking to me about this, I'm like, you know, I don't know how to describe where I'm from except for to say that I'm from North Portland and that my My experience is not with speaking Klamath. It's not with living on a reservation. It's not with these, sort of like recognizable like Indian experiences, because I'm from the city. And even though the neighborhood and family that I grew up with is Indian, and most people I know would recognize my stories and experiences very much so, I do know what to say, but I feel like I need to just claim my own experience, like that if I say that I have some connection to some pre-contact indigeneity, like that I just don't feel like that's so. Now, certainly, do I have contact with my ancestors, though? Yes. And that's, you know, the haunting, and that's what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow in my presentation. So, I don't know, that's where my head's been at. Does that make sense? I don't know.
No, somewhat.
Somewhat.
You should.
We'll edit this out later so you won't have to hear it.
You should. But you should tell everyone about the 45th generation.
Oh. So we're talking about like Indigenous studies and Native studies, and Thomas has a lot of things to say about, the recovery of indigeneity for Chicano people, because I guess that's big at Berkeley. And neither one of us have like strong negative ideas about that. I think that within indigeneity, like that's just something that's going to have to be reckoned with, like the who's going to be Indigenous. And he's like, oh, have you heard of this group called the Streets or something? And I was like, no. And he's like, well, there's this group, and he says they call themselves like, we're 45th generation Roman. Da, da, da. I was like, you're kidding. And he's like, no. And I'm like, that's crazy. You know, like, I don't know. We'll see. I don't really have anything to say other than that.
45th generation Roman.
Yeah. Is that where it's going to go?
No, it's, I don't know. It's interesting because my brain is working trying to think about how to talk about that.
There's well, so many I mean, okay, but what about the Druids about and stuff? Like Romans, like, was that ever Indigenous? Like, what about this?
It depends on the kind of the definition of indigeneity, but it's just kind of like, wait, is this group like a band or is it?
It's
like
a band.
Oh, okay. I wonder what their intent is for saying that. Are they trying to like? Are they just kind of being facetious? But it seems like they're kind of being whatever their intent is. That they're kind of trying to kind of surpass the claims of. You know, because there's always, like, for on Guam, for example, so no one can really deny that Chamorros are the indigenous people of Guam. But there's all these interesting little games that take place through which that can be done. So, for instance, kind of in the tourist district on Guam, which is this beach, which was really beautiful before, but now it's kind of developed, it's covered in hotels called Tuman. Every time they would build a hotel, you know, they would dig deep into the ground and they would constantly find these bones of Chamorros from 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 500 years ago, etc. And so for a while, you know, they would just throw the bones away, the developmental companies. After a while, people started getting pissed off. The government intervened and said that, no, you have to, if you find these sites of old villages, these burial sites, etc., you have to preserve them until an archaeologist can come in, collect them, you know, analyze it, study it, and then you can keep going. This eventually started this huge archaeological industry on on Guam with people coming in and setting up shop because they were building so many hotels and so many structures that seriously, you could be a full-time archaeologist on Guam. But then once these bones are found, there's this issue. Because some people say that, they're our ancestors, these are bones, you bury them again. Other people say, no, we can use these bones to unlock where we really come from. And so it becomes this issue where, and so because maybe for those of you who aren't familiar with the way Pacific history is written, it's written against kind of the existences of the people in the Pacific Islanders. So, for instance, in Guam, like how did Chamorros get there? So they couldn't have been there from the beginning of the universe or whatever. They had to migrate from someplace larger. And so they migrated from Asia. But then within that, there's this game too that, well, they couldn't have sailed there. They must have been blown off course. And they
It's
were
all about
shipwrecked there.
canoes.
They were shipwrecked there, yeah. They didn't mean to go there. They didn't have the capabilities to go there. It was just an accident, and then they settled there. And then so in the game of analyzing bones and saying that, well, these people originally come from Taiwan, or they come from Indonesia, or they come from China, wherever, it's this game of basically saying, surpassing whatever claims indigenous people have today to make them moot.
Yeah.
So for instance, if you go on message boards on the internet and you find someone who's representing themselves as Chamorro, someone who doesn't know anything about them will go to Wikipedia, look up what it is, and say, you're not really Chamorro, you guys are actually Taiwanese. Like I looked it up, you guys are really from Taiwan. And so suddenly the political implications, the political claim that I am Chamorro is like usurped because someone says, well, you guys didn't even really come from there. And so, oh, hey.
Hey, we're just
Oh,
doing a
wait.
little podcast. We'll pause it.
Oh, yeah, pause it. Wait, sorry, we had a little interruption there. But I guess I was, I mean, I'm trying to connect it in my head, but I'm trying to connect that point. So kind of the easy way that indigenous claims are diffused. So, and the games, like the games, indigenous people are all familiar with the games that are so easy for scientists, social scientists, anthropologists, archaeologists, linguists, and then everyday people just participate in that. Like how you prove that someone doesn't exist or how you prove that their claim to existing is called into question. So you say that, well, you can, it goes from the fact that, anyways, I won't go into them. Maybe another time I'll
Well,
say
I'm
that.
convinced
But
though, like with this whole like the way they find these bodies here, and they're like, oh, but this skull isn't an indigenous person, it's a white person. Like they're
oh
gonna
yeah.
white people were the original inhabitants of the,
No.
I mean it's coming.
And so I think that the way that people, like, so in the way that someone claims, like, oh, I'm a 45th generation Roman, whether or not that's fictitious or not, like the, what's it called? It's interesting because basically it's a move to intervene with kind of the productive and the critical aspects that kind of people of color have done within their kind of within the space that they've been given. So people of color, racialized people, indigenous people, the world is divided into political and cultural realms, and you're the culture. You're not the political. The political is white people signing a document in 1776, white people freeing slaves, white people saving the world in 1944, 45. Your culture, you can participate in that, but you, in your existence, in your long histories of tradition, you never produced anything political, anything important. You lived in teepees and you talked to each other and you smoked peace pipes or something. Or on Guam, you fished and you hunted and you didn't do anything. So you have no political value.
We called it maize.
As time has gone on, kind of the cultural realm that people of color has been given has slowly contested the political realm. Has slowly basically said, basically worked to break kind of that hegemonic hold that whiteness, that white people in the United States have on claiming that this nation is ours because we are the politics of it. You're the lazy, the drunk people, the poor people, you're the backwards people, the primitive people. We're the ones who have freedom and democracy. But then in the way that you claim, people claim ethnic options, people claim like, oh, I'm actually Irish, I'm actually Italian,
yeah,
I'm actually these things, or I have that ancestor way back there who does this. Mm-hmm. They are working to kind of diffuse, diminish the claims that people of color, indigenous people, are working with, working to claim that political, working to kind of put themselves in the cultural too, take, kind of colonize the cultural as well. And so that's what that, when Angie told me about the 45th generation Roman, like that totally like sparked it in my head.
Well, and I think that I was thinking too about like this whole imaginary indigeneity, right? I mean, and that's why like when they were asking me, well, where are you guys from? What, you know, I was like, you know what? I never lived in an earth, you know, home. I never did these things. So what I can tell you is that I'm from North Portland, that my family's from North Portland, that I'm, and you know what? It's plenty. My plate is full. My cup runneth over with indigeneity from North Portland. I don't have to, it's that way, babe. I don't feel like, I guess I just want to like resist that urge to make myself more indigenous, you know, more indigenous than thou, more, we were talking about the Chicanos and the Aztec, the Aslan, the whole, like, I mean, I actually think, and I haven't put a lot of thought into this, but I actually think, like, there's work to do with recovering indigeneity, like, but the imaginary has to be dealt with. Like, it can't be,
No, it has to be it's best a...
It has to be political.
It's best a strategy.
Okay.
That's the thing.
There you go.
I mean, so we're not supposed to talk about strategic essentialism anymore, but Spivak named something that has always been there and continues to be there, even if it's intellectually unsound or academically unstable or whatever. And so, for example... Like, Native American people that have claims to certain land, and then a municipality, the state, the federal government comes in and says that, no, we claim that as well.
Yeah.
So the decision on who will get it becomes kind of a performance. So the state, the municipality, basically just has to say, they don't have to actually do anything, because the case will be decided based on how well those natives can perform authentic indigeneity. And so, kind of, so it's not that you have to actually be those things and you have to believe in all of your heart that you are authentic or whatever, but there is a strategy to that. And so, I think that, I mean, and it's one of the things that you're kind of forced to do, you know? But it needs to be resisted at the same time. As in, those categories, those concepts, those notions, they come from anthropologists, which designed a photo, designed a picture, and you have to match that. But that photo has to be changed. And you cannot accept that photo as the authentic state of your being, or the being that you are trying to live up to. But people do that all the time. People try to get back to their roots. But basically, they get misdirected in the ways in which they reach back. They get misdirected, and they end up in some anthropologist's book. And so, no, I totally understand what you're saying.
Well, I'm still putting it into words, because, I mean, it has to do with the political. I was thinking about my grandmother, because I was thinking about, we're talking about ghosts, monsters, and the dead. And I have a presentation to do tomorrow. And we talk a lot about haunting here at UCSD. We're fond of Avery Gordon's Ghostly Matters. I'm sure it's been mentioned before on this podcast. And I was like, well, what do I want to see at a conference? You know, what do I want to... And I personally like to see people who are engaged with something, to me, that feels really real. And for me, that means personal. And so I was thinking about my grandmother. Twice this last year, somebody has told me that she's here. Like, that's not a big surprise to me. Like a lot of people of color, or just maybe even a lot of people. I don't assume that I'm alone, you know. But I was getting a massage from this woman, and she says, "Oh," she said, "your grandmother's here, and she wants you to speak for her." And I was like, "Oh, okay." You know, I had a chill. I'm not, you know, made of stone. And then she bent over the table and said to me, "If you wanted to know if you're on the right path, you are." And that, she told me last year, and I was kind of disappointed because I was sort of hoping she'd say, "Go home, go back to your mom. You don't have to do grad school. You're right. It's not. It's too hard. Get out while you still can." But that's not what she said. She said, "You have to stay." And at the time, I was like, "Speak. What does a first-year grad student have to say? You know, what can I say for my grandmother?" And then this morning, I was thinking more about it, and then it happened again with another woman later, but she didn't know it was my grandmother. She just said, "There's a woman here, and she's holding her throat, and she can't talk." And I was like, "Okay, I understand." Part of being Native is that I know personally, like, I mean, I know from just my mom that she is Modoc and Klamath and Cherokee and Seminole. Now, you can only be one thing, though, on your Angie. You can only enroll in one tribe. So she's Klamath. And so in many ways, my grandmother has been erased from our family through this because she was Cherokee. And it probably had a lot to do with the time. It probably had a lot to do with, it's funny because you have to choose, but then the Klamath tribes were terminated. And but then that the disbursement, the money from the land came in handy because my Modoc Klamath grandfather, after terrorizing his family, left his family and his wife, who had multiple sclerosis, in a wheelchair, and the six kids ranging from ages 11 to 4. And it doesn't really surprise me that my grandmother is coming to me, because I'm a single parent, and I think about how erased she's been and how she stayed. You know, he got to walk away, and they were glad to see him go. He was abusive. But all of that land, all of that stuff that we have to deal with in our lives, politically and socially, is there in my family in just these generations. So I don't have to hearken back to some ancient pre-contact time. I'm plenty Indian here, you know, where I'm from. You know, I grew up a block away from the house where, you know, my mom and her siblings were tortured and tormented. Anyway, not to bring everybody down, I just wanted to say, like, I was thinking about Forrest Whitaker, because in the blogs after the Oscars, a lot of people were like, well, that was a unique speech.
What did he say? I didn't.
Oh, he thanked his ancestors.
Oh.
Yeah.
Cool.
It was cool, and people were like, some of the blog writers were like, that was unique, and then, so then some of the people of color blog writers were like, well, I mean, we were not surprised, right? Because what kind of a world is it where you don't inhabit it with your ancestors?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good place to end.
All right.
You brought it back.
Thank you.
You brought it back.
I'm learning. She can be taught. We hope you all have a good weekend. We're going to come back with some more podcasts. So if all your podcasting Indigenous voicing needs were not met in this episode, fear not, because we're going to be back shortly. We're going to try and get Ross. We have Jose Fuste wants to podcast with us. And yeah, we're just going to see who we can
snag.
Yeah. You want to sing something, Megat? We did promise music.
I liked the song that you were thinking about earlier, the I'm a Lonely Indian. I'm the only Indian. I think you should sing that song.
Only living boy in New York, right? How does that one go?
I don't know. I've never heard that
song. That Paul Simon song?
Oh, I've never heard that one.
Oh, dang. Dude, we got to sing something we know.
Well, what do we know?
You know that Liz Phair song.
Extraordinary.
And I hardly know you.
Oh, I don't know that
something
song.
Something was meant to be. Oh, come on. You're always singing something. You not can't that. Think of anything?
Yeah, I know. But then on the spot, no, because it mixes with, I have to sing something. What can I sing that doesn't sound completely
you
bad?
You know what? We promise that next time before we start, we'll decide what we're going to sing.
Yeah, we never learn. So you are learning, but as a collective podcasting unit, we never learned that. But you just sang for everybody.
Yeah.
So
it's done.
Yay.
Take care.
So
thanks for listening.
Yes, thank you for listening. If you have any questions or comments, suggestions.
We love email.
Email mlbasquiat@hotmail.com.
Or just go to the blog and comment your heart out.
Okay, bye.
All right, bye. Thank you.